And the doctors will not speak to us, and they won't release any information to the family. Meanwhile, Mumia is shackled, probably to a bed. There are four guards, a phalanx of guards, guarding him and keeping us from the room. 10 feet away, we were able to see that he was behind this room.
What do you feel needs to happen?
We need to defend Mumia's life immediately. He's in enemy territory right now, and we need people to call the hospital, Schuylkill Medical Center in Pottsville, Pennsylvania. We need people to call the prison and demand that he be seen by outside doctors to really assess the situation.
Johanna, we have to leave it there. I thank you for being with us. Johanna Fernandez, professor of history at Baruch College, CUNY, one of the coordinators of the campaign to bring Mumia home, it's called. That does it for the show. A very happy birthday to our own Mike Burke. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltzer, Amate, Nirmin Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alcock, Hani Masood, Rabbi Karen, Dina Gezder, Amy Littlefield. I'm Amy Goodman with Aaron Matzah.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8 o'clock. Coming up next is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show with our host, Joe Uris. Today, we'll talk about the history of organized labor.
We're at the Erez Crossing, which is where you enter Gaza from. So apparently, when you go into Gaza, you have to walk until you get to the first town there. And apparently that walk is very dangerous.
KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of Indigenous Rights, Palestine, and Academic Freedom. Thursday, April 9th at 6:30 p.m. at Portland State University's Smith Center, room 338. Guest speaker will be Stephen Saleta, former Virginia Tech professor. That's Indigenous Rights, Palestine, and Academic Freedom. Sponsored by Students United for Palestinian Equal Rights. On Thursday, April 9th, 6:30 p.m. at Portland State University, Smith Center, room 338. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Tune in Tuesday nights from 8 to 10 p.m. for The Melting Pot, featuring DJs, producers, and electronic artists from around the globe. Win tickets and stay up on events each and every Tuesday from 8 to 10 p.m. on The Melting Pot, right here at 90.7 FM KBOO.
Than the feeble strength of one, but the union makes us strong.
Solidarity forever, solidarity forever, solidarity forever, for the union makes us strong.
It is we who plowed the prairies, built the cities where they trade, dug the mines and built the workshops, endless miles of railroad laid. Now we stand outcast and starving, mid the wonders we have made, but the union makes us strong.
Solidarity forever, solidarity forever, solidarity forever, for the union makes us strong.
They have taken untold millions that they never toiled to earn, but without our brain and muscle, not a single wheel can turn. We can break their haughty power, gain our freedom when we learn that the union makes us strong.
Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever.
In our hands is placed a power greater than their hoarded gold, greater than the might of atoms magnified a thousandfold. We can bring to birth a new world from the ashes of the old, for the union makes us strong.
Good morning. Good morning. Whoa, there's more. No, there's no more. This is KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial here in Portland, Oregon. This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. Abe isn't here. Abe Proctor is not here. I am. My name's Joe Uris. And we're going to talk about a little bit about union history and then focus maybe in on some issues that are happening all over the United States right now. And the point, the larger point that I'm going to be making, and I'll say it out front, is that during the era when organized labor was most strong in the late 30s, 40s, 50s, and into the 60s, there was a powerful middle class income-wise of working people in the United States. People could buy homes. People could send their children to schools, including colleges and universities. In general, things were looking up. Now, this was not an era that was without trouble. This was also the period of time of the Cold War. This was a period of time of vast anti-communist efforts. And this was also a time when every effort that could be made was organized to break organized labor. But ironically, if you look at economics in a purely neutral way, there are, in the classic sense, two forces at work. There is supply, God knows we got that, and then there is demand. Today's weird economics, even the Obama economics, even the right-wing economics, even the weird economics of the George Bushes, seem to ignore the notion of demand. You pay people well, they buy stuff. They buy stuff, we all prosper. Now, of course, interceding with all of that is the fact that the resources of the world are becoming more and more strained. But please understand that when organized labor was powerful, when about 35% of the American workforce were members of organized unions, we had a society where people, ordinary people with ordinary jobs, could live very, very well, could own homes, could own automobiles, could send their children to college. This was real. This is not propaganda. This is not a left-wing or right-wing issue. This is a simple economic fact. And what has happened regularly and steadily since that time is an effort by the very most foolish elements of capital to destroy the power of organized labor and to reduce the wages of workers in real wage terms. And this is the situation we're looking at today. Once we have the Trans-Pacific Partnership, we, American workers, will be competing with workers in other countries, many of which are not allowed to organize in unions, are paid many, 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 many dollars less per hour than our workers. And the inevitable consequence of this, and we already see it, is that stuff, electronic stuff, furniture, cars, all kinds of things are made outside of the United States, produced by workers outside of the U.S., many of whom do not have worker rights, and are sold here by vast international corporations whose loyalty to the United States, their real loyalty, is non-existent. We need to face this. We need to face this in a profoundly serious way. We need to put aside our left-right biases and realize what is actually happening. And I'm going to try to help you with that. My focus will be on the history of organized labor. I'm not going to go into detail. I'm going to talk in general terms. But I want to establish certain things. And I'm going to, if I have time, and if you will permit me, and if you call me with this, we'll talk a little bit about what's happening to one of the strongest unions in the region, in this city, the ILWU, the International Longshoremen and Warehousemen's Union. And We'll talk about the role of a vast Pacific, what shall I call it? Well, a Philippine company that dominates the ports, the container shipping ports. And we'll talk about what has happened to other unions. And perhaps if we have time, we'll talk about how the police union got its start with the support of the ILWU. There's irony there. And we'll talk about many, many other issues. And you'll be participating in it because you can call us and give us your feelings. 231-8187. That's 231-8187. Well, first of all, let's start out with the Great Depression. The Great Depression provided real incentive for labor, particularly workers in the coal mines, workers in steel, and in the automotive industry, to fight hard for good decent living wages. And that struggle was successful. It was supported by, and many people feel this was wrong, but supported by the Democratic Party and the administration of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Now, in response to that, various laws limiting the power of organized labor were passed, including the Wagner Act. But in the course of all of that, sit-down strikes, all kinds of struggles, sit-down strikes were very successful at General Motors and others, and set the tone for a more vigilant, a more serious organized labor struggle. Not that there hadn't been that before. Now, the Great Depression did not end because of increased wages and increased employment by working people. But with World War II, and by the end of World War II, way into the 50s, 35% of the workforce in the United States were members of labor unions. Now it's, I don't know, about 11%, maybe less, and shrinking all the time. The current struggle is, for example, in states like Wisconsin under a man who would be president, Scott Walker, to destroy what's left of the more powerful public employees unions, to essentially reestablish or establish what are called right-to-work laws, which are laws that make it virtually impossible for unions to stand their ground, make a struggle toward the bottom a constant for every working man and woman in the United States. This is the real thing. This is the stuff of which I think modern friendly fascism is made. And I want to hear from you on this. I'll do some more talking, but I really want to hear from you. This is so important. This is so real. This is what's happening. In Portland, the ILWU, which is once perhaps the most militant and most powerful union on the West Coast, hardworking longshoremen, these people are now under stress and under attack, particularly in Portland, because the Port of Portland essentially has contracted with a Philippine company to run the container industry. Now, just a little history briefly. Harry Bridges, then head of the ILWU, and others negotiated contracts recognizing the inevitability of containerization of cargo. It used to be cargo was called bulk cargo. You know, you loaded it. It was a rough and very physical job, but with the mechanization that comes with containers, a new agreement was made. Essentially, the union membership was reduced. People were given very good pensions. The remaining workforce was well paid. And the operation of very technically serious machines, giant cranes and so on, became common. At the same time, the ILWU began to focus on other organizations. In Hawaii, they organized workers in hospitals. Here in Portland, Oregon, interestingly enough, the workers at Powell's Bookstore became members of the ILWU and engaged in a very, very serious struggle. Not a vicious struggle, not a violent struggle, but a serious one. Now Powell's is a union shop. I was asked, by the way, by the Oregonian back in 2000. I was asked to write about that struggle. The Oregonian's expectation was that I'd be talking about a family fight. Well, I went into it with that idea, but it quickly became obvious that it was a traditional union struggle. This was when they were trying to negotiate their first new contract after the union had been accepted by Powell's. And one of the things that happened that May Day, you may remember this, some of you, was a big labor march, the Wiccans, all kinds of people marched without a permit in the streets with agreement of the city. Then the police chief, Kroger, essentially decided by rumors that there had been an attack on a Nike store, it turned out not to be true, to stop the march. And I was in a suit and I was, and suddenly the first I knew that there was real trouble was that the police on horses began to attack the crowd, knocking over wagons, some of them with little kids. Suddenly the costume of those horse police patrols were changed. They took off their cowboy hats and put on armor. And the crowd was driven, forced by the police to the riverfront on the west side. At the front, they were surrounded on all sides, on one side by the water of the Willamette River, on the other three sides by the police. And the crowd began to react very severely. The police response was to use less than lethal weapons, beanbags, all kinds of weapons of that nature, against the crowd. And that police riot continued for some time. I escaped. Being kind of a chicken sort of guy, there was at that time a bar called McCall's at the riverfront, and I went in there, and there was a big bouncer. He said, "You can't come in here," thinking I was part of the demo. And I said, no, I'm a reporter. I need a drink. I got a drink. And he let me in. I got a drink. I went back up to the park blocks in time to see the several policemen beating the hell out of some poor guy. This, by the way, was photographed from the air by, I think it was Channel 6 in their helicopter. I then went over to where my principal's sourcing was, the Powell's bookstore, and the police had formed a line separating the demonstrators at Powell's from the rest of the crowd. Meanwhile, the ILWU was in convention, and it was quickly revealed at the convention that, hey, there was this struggle going on, and there was this nastiness happening. And the membership of the ILWU, now this is very different than the crowd at the May Day crowd. May Day crowd was young. May Day crowd had children. May Day crowd had a lot of moms. May Day crowd was a fun crowd, you know? Now, suddenly down the street came this huge number, most of them older guys and gals who were big, who were strong, who were not going to take nonsense. And the union people marched to the police lines, and the police said, "Oh, you can't cross this." And they said, "The hell we can't." And after a very brief negotiation, the union, one of the things that was said there, and it's very significant, the head of the union said, "Hey, you police wouldn't even have a union if it wasn't for us, the ILWU," which is true, by the way, because the ILWU went to the police union when they were trying to get organized and they couldn't get anywhere because they couldn't go on strike, and said, "Listen, we can put up, if you put up informational pickets, we won't cross them." That forced the then separate DOC commission and the Port of Portland into negotiation, which led to the creation of the police union. At any rate, the crowd of organized labor from their big national convention, once at the Hilton Hotel, now in the street, crossed the line in a huge march and going around, and political talks and so on ensued. It was a very interesting, and for me, a kind of an exciting moment. It was the last big job I think I was given by the Oregonian. They just thought I was not the right guy. But it was published, to their credit. My editors did support me in my observations. I think I did a very accurate reporting job. There was no question in my mind that it was a police riot. Now, I only mention that because it is important to recognize that a struggle by organized labor using their physical power sometimes is necessary to produce progress for ordinary workers. The number of people now in organized labor is very low, less than, some people say 11%, maybe 12% of the whole workforce. The areas where organized labor are most strong are in the public service sectors, in teaching and in civil service, federal, state, and local. And right now, the effort by the right wing, by the Koch brothers and others, to crush what's left of organized labor is well underway. Scott Walker in Wisconsin is pushing, as are many other states, so-called right-to-work laws, which essentially are an attempt to destroy the public unions, to destroy the teachers' unions, to destroy the nurses' unions, to destroy all manner of workers. And this is really significant, and you want to pay attention to it. There is a national movement against the Postal Service, which is unionized, an attempt to privatize postal services completely, to do away with the Postal Service, a tradition beginning with Benjamin Franklin way back when. If that's successful, everything from there on will be privatized. And this is not some kind of an accident. This is not a reaction to excesses by organized labor. This is a struggle, a class struggle, that is a typification of end capitalism, a moment in history where an effort is being made to destroy the power of working people in every context, ignoring the significance of supply and demand in the classic economic sense. And this is happening not just here, but everywhere. But the U.S. is taking, unfortunately, a lead in this. I want to hear from you. If you're a union member, I want to hear from you and your experiences, good and bad. If you are not, I want to hear from your experiences, good and bad. I want to get your reactions to all of this. 231-8187. James.
Good morning, Joe. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to preface by saying my granddad was a union pipe fitter in the oil fields in Oklahoma and Texas in the 20s and 30s.
Mm-hmm.
My dad is a union plumber. I was a union plumber. I am no longer a member of the union for my own reasons.
Mm-hmm.
But what I wanted to point out is that I believe that the union faction was created by imperialists so as to divide the union of the people.
Oh.
It was one of the tactics that was used to divide the union of the people as a whole.
Why do you think that?
Because it was successful, and we are divided as a people.
Well, wait a minute. You're using the kind of an argument where you say, "Well, this is what it's like now." Therefore, that was what made it happen. There's no causation in your argument.
There is. Yes. It would take time to.
I know.
Lay out the evidence. We don't have that kind of time here.
Okay.
But. That is what I've discovered. That is the imperial powers. They create various factions, and they pit these factions together.
So you wait, hold on a second. You think that organized labor was created by imperialists?
Yes. It was a tactic used to divide the union of the people.
Well, I'm gonna let you go, but I just one thing, James. I just have to say this: there's no causal relationship here. I mean, you're positing you're positing a theory. Well, who was Samuel Gompers? Was he a guy creating this when he was creating AFL-CIO? I mean, the AFL.
The Koch brothers.
Koch.
The Koch brothers are from my perspective, as a classical liberal, are leftist.
Really?
Yes.
Okay, man. I'm going to have to let you go. Give others an opportunity. Thank you very much for the call. 231-8187. Who? Eric, you're on the air.
Yeah, Joe, we've talked a lot. I was at MDC recently, and I've been a union member for a number of organizations. OHSU, I was lead steward for AFSCME 75 and executive board for community liaison, which is a nice way to say I hold your hand while you're getting laid off. Most currently, I'm with SEIU 503, the home care workers, as well as your welfare workers and kind of like that. But the most recent scary thing is the quasi or fake unions that are out there. In particular, PTI is Professional Transportation Incorporated here on the West Coast. They take the engineers and conductors to their respective trains and transit them around, they allegedly have a union. You're paying dues, but there's no reps west of the Mississippi.
Huh. I don't know much about that. That's really interesting and scary.
Yeah, very scary. And if they can do that, and there's PTI and Coach America and Helzensberger is the only real union back east. They have a web page and everything, but they don't have anything west of the Mississippi. And they are being investigated by Congress and a number of other people for basically suppressing their people, firing their people for various and sundry stupid reasons.
Okay, well, thank you for hipping us to that. I appreciate that. It makes me a little sad, but it's good to know.
Okay, thanks, Joe.
Thanks very much. I just want to make a few statistical points here. In 1945, 38% of the workforce were unionized. Remember what I said earlier. We had a vast, successful middle class that were sending their children to college, that were able to advance in their careers, who were able to buy houses and automobiles and so on, consequent to having living wages. That number has shrinked, has really shrinked incredibly. By 95, we really had a huge, huge loss of organized labor. When the Petco, the air traffic controllers were broken by Ronald Reagan, that was the end. That was the beginning of the end. We saw a real reversal of unionization in the society. Today, there's more members of unions in the public sector, which is now being broken systematically by the Koch brothers and others. The private sector, in the building trades, and some other areas, unionism and the union ethic continues. One of the things that's really important is to recognize that the AFL, as it merged with the CIO, the Congress of Industrial Workers, in that merger process and in the years following World War II, when the Cold War cranked up, the CIO particularly kicked out all of its leftists, particularly its communists, kicked them all out, kicked out their more radical elements, and essentially reduced unionism from the notion of its political power and its political importance, and in fact, its attempt to be a partner in capitalism, and reduced itself merely to a force seeking wages. When you destroy the ideologies of the left, when you deny the significance of a Marxist analysis of the working class, when you in fact kick your most radical elements out, you leave your unions much weakened. And that's exactly what happened. A Taft-Hartley Act, all kinds of laws passed in the period following World War II, reduced the power of organized labor. And in that process, reduced the income and wealth and security of working people. And that process has gone on in a straight line. You can just look at any graph anywhere of the incomes of workers in the United States, lay that graph over the membership of labor unions, and it's obvious. The relationship is absolutely obvious. We are now a nation who has a working class that is earning by real dollars far less than it did in the 1950s. And that is not, that's going to keep on. Once the Pacific, I don't know that it will be successful, once the Pacific Trans-Pacific Partnership is finished, essentially environmental protections, protections for organized labor and so on will be destroyed. Because when you compete on the international market with workers who are not free to organize unions, workers who are paid way less than American workers, products, it's just a simple logic of capitalism. Products are produced cheaply, shipped here, and sold here to whoever can afford to buy them. This is a pattern that we need to understand. We also need to understand that the breaking of the left in America. Earlier we had a call about a kind of a conspiratorial notion. I do have a conspiratorial notion. I think there was an organized effort and continues to be one by the most reactionary elements of capitalism trying to destroy the power of the working class. I think that's real. And you can call me up and say, oh, you're full of it. But I want to hear from you. I want to hear your facts and your argument. And I want to hear from people who agree and disagree with me, my position is that we need a powerful labor movement in the United States. We need to, if necessary, build it from the ground up, but we need it. We need it using the existing unions and, if necessary, new unions. I have to, just my background, I come out of a union family, union tradition. I've been in various unions during my career as a college instructor, as a professor, et cetera. I was a member initially in the community college system of the Oregon Education Association, the higher ed part of it. I was head of that for the state. When I moved on to the university, I eventually ended up working very briefly, I have to say, for the what I laughingly called the AAUP, that is to say, a non-union union of the professoriate at Portland State University. But unions are important. Unions do represent the interests of workers. They aren't always progressive. They aren't always right. Certainly during the period of time when they agreed to smash their left wing, that was a foolish move. But without that counterpower to the enormous power of capital, working people have nothing, absolutely nothing to protect them in the course of a history that clearly is pushing against workers having a living wage. I want to hear from you, 231-8187. Michael, hey, Michael, how are you?
Hi, Joe.
How you doing?
I'm good. So I got a question for you. I got two questions, actually.
Okay.
Hey,
you know, Michael, I always put you on because you're one of the few people who will argue to the right.
Well, I know. I'm glad I can represent that kind of diversity here at Cable.
Go ahead.
Okay. So, first thing is, I think there's a fundamental problem with public employee unions. And the fundamental problem is this. They work hard to get Democrats elected. And then they sit across the bargaining table from those Democrats, and there's nobody representing the taxpayer. And, you know, that's kind of a conflict of interest. And the worst example of that here in Oregon is what happened in the 90s with that 8% guarantee on the union fund investments. Do you remember that?
I certainly do.
I mean, they almost bankrupted the state with that.
Well, no. Almost bankrupted is an exaggeration. It was costly. You know that was in lieu of wage hikes, right? You understand
that.
That's
what they say, you know? But what that kind of means to me is, well, the Democrats who had been elected by the unions wanted to give them back a gift, and since they couldn't manage to get salaries as high as what the unions wanted passed, I don't know who, the voters or whoever, they did it in this subterfuge way that no one really understood at the time. Oh, an 8% guarantee on your investments. And then the stock market doesn't do it, and the stock market doesn't happen to go up 8%, and the state's on the hook for it. I mean, that's horrible.
But that's no longer so. I mean, you know that 8% is gone.
Well, I know it's gone now, but I also remember the effect it had on the state's finances before it was gone.
Okay, so your argument is essentially unions, public employee unions, got a good deal at the expense of the taxpayers because the managements of the public sector didn't want to have a struggle with union people on wages. Is that your argument?
Except I would call it not a good deal, but an extortionate deal. They robbed the state blind, is what it looks like to me.
Okay, but you were playing with language here. You do understand that.
I don't know if I'm playing. I'm expressing myself articulately, I think.
What was your second point?
Okay, and the second question I had was, you apparently know a fair amount of from the longshoreman side.
I don't know a fair amount. I'm ignorant. I haven't worked on the docks in years, and I only have a few friends who are in the union, so I can't say I'm an expert.
Okay, so what was the deal with those two refrigerator container jobs? That whole fight over that, because I know someone, an old family friend, who's sort of tightly associated with the electricians union, mm-hmm. and the story I got there was, this bunch of thugs decided to take away our lunch money.
Well, it was a jurisdictional dispute, and I really don't have time to go into the details of that. But the main force behind all of this, I really believe, is this Philippine company that has a contract to handle the bulk cargo. I mean the containerized cargoes, and it is by reputation and by actual action. Very much interested in destroying unions and very much interested in having essentially a lot of the work done by the longshoremen move to other places where there is no organized labor.
But, you know, the thing about the electricians doing the refrigerator containers, that preceded ICSI coming in. That was a deal. That was the way it was for, decades.
Yeah, I unfortunately, I do not know enough detail. I'm putting this together in a larger context. I think I will devote a show. I think you've raised an interesting point, though. I will devote a show in the near future to what's going on in the Port of Portland, because I'm not knowledgeable enough to have an argument about it.
Okay, sounds good.
Fair enough?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much for the call.
Sure, bye.
Bye. All right, I want to hear from all of you. The only thing I do know about the port is that this Philippine company has a reputation as a union-busting outfit, and that is the group that manages the port for the Port of Portland. And they lost, in the course of this struggle, the Hanjin Company, the big container company, has decided to drop Portland from its calling places and move on to Seattle and Tacoma and San Francisco. So that's what I know, which is very limited. 231-8187. Peter, you're on the air.
Hey. I just want to... Well, first of all, my background is my mother's a postal carrier. She's been in union her whole life. And I feel like it's helped helped her secure things like retirement, vacation, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like that's kind of an older union. But... in my experience, I'm a low-wage worker. Most of my friends are low-wage workers. And I got friends that work at, like, say, UPS or Salt Lake City Airport. And people really low on the totem pole that receive a great deal of pressure to join the unions. And from all a practical perspective, the benefits are not that great. And they end up just taking a good chunk out of your paycheck, which is... really tough if you're on the lower end of the spectrum.
Well, you know, that's a common complaint. I think one of the things we need to understand, though, for example, UPS a few years back negotiated a contract that gave very good wages and benefits to their workers. And that is very important, very, very important. Both drivers and loaders and so on were given a living wage. Now, do unions... in cases by case, sometimes violate the rights of workers? I can't speak to that. That is a possibility. What is the reality, however, is that, again, in UPS and other carriers, the unions gave workers living wages, which made it possible for their children to go to colleges, which made it possible for them to own homes and so on. But I right. see your point. I mean, I hear what you're saying.
Yeah, it's just there has to be some way for the lowest end of the people, because, you know, a lot of the good-paying jobs, like these longshoremen jobs, you know, they're quite good compared to, you know, let's say you're a janitor at the airport, and, you know, there's just not much they do, I think, for the lowest of the wage workers.
Okay. I mean, I hear you.
There's got to be some way we can work that out.
Well, I think, I'm just going to say this very briefly, and I appreciate your point. We need a rejuvenation, a rehabilitation, and a rebirth of organized labor in this country. And we need to be very, very strong, particularly working people, in demanding justice. And this is, we live in a climate now in which any effort to increase the incomes of working people are stopped at every level by powerful interests of the ownership class.
Well, I can attest to that.
Okay, man. I'm glad you called, though. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
231-8187. We're talking about the history of organized labor, and we're talking about the labor struggles of today. And we will probably be dealing with many of these issues, not just today, but other days. I want to hear from you. 231-8187. John, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm going to go to a little bit of academia. this person at work gave me this thing by Michael Snyder. March 19th, 2015, and it's in Featured Stories.
Mm-hmm.
Uh, it, It's about 10 charts which show we are much worse off than we were before. Mm-hmm. And I'm just going to cut to the chase about money, because everything's about money. And this is from the Social Security Administration. 39% of American workers make less than $20,000 a year. 52% of American workers make less than $30,000. 63% of American workers make less than $40,000. And 72% of American workers make less than $50,000.
Mm.
And this is from the Social Security Administration. Now, there's a variety of other charts, all depressing, of course. Government dependents, people, men in their prime time, about their inactivity rate, and labor force participation rate.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, it's like 10 charts that sort of take the pulse of what's really going on in cultural work.
Yeah, what was the site for that, so people can look it up?
Oh, okay. Well, just a minute. I'm going around and around and around.
No, you're doing good. Go ahead.
It's featured in featured stories titled "No Comments" by Michael Snyder.
Oh, okay.
Economic collapse.
Can find it.
Yeah, just Google Michael Snyder economic collapse. Featured stories titled "No Comments."
Thank you.
10 charts, which shows up what's going on.
Yeah, I really appreciate that call. That is good information and sad information.
Well, you know, it's that inactivity thing, like nobody's doing squat.
Well, and we also have a vast number of people who are either underemployed or unemployed and having given up seeking work.
Well, yeah. Well, anyway, that's all I have to, you know.
No, I appreciate the information, man. Thank you very much. Bye-bye. 231-8187. We're talking about organized labor, the history thereof, and the struggles of today. Who do we have? Frances, how are you?
Hi. I've been a union child forever. My father, who was a son of Irish immigrants, was a business agent for the iron workers here in Portland. And my brother works for the iron workers back east.
Yeah, I just want to say the iron workers are the people, many of our listeners may not know this, the iron workers are the people who climb up on the high steel and build the big buildings.
And the bridges.
And the bridges.
Right. And my brother is working on the repairs of the George Washington Bridge right now.
Wow.
My father was a business agent for the iron workers during Hatfield's administration as a governor.
Mm-hmm.
And he's the one that had the dispute that they were going on strike, and the governor ordered that they not go on strike. But it ended up at the White House with the Secretary of Labor, and the union won.
Mm-hmm.
What I've noticed, and my brother has commented on, is that now union leaders, a lot of them are compromising too much. They're like becoming quasi-management representatives in a lot of regards.
Sort of apologists for management.
Right. And I agree with you totally that the unions need, that there needs to be a new surge among labor. One thing that I've observed is that all those people that work at the call centers, they need a union. Really.
Boy, they really do.
They need one. And they don't have one. They need one.
What is really, Francis, I think you know this, but what has really happened is, with the Cold War, there has been an effort to destroy the left wing of organized labor, which included communists and non-communists. In the course of that, the militancy of the unions was stripped away, and union leadership became very well off relative to the ordinary worker. In the process of that, the strong effort to continue organizing labor, to grow the unions and to move into new areas, really did not advance as it should have. The areas where there has been progress are farm workers and public workers. And it's right. Unfortunate that this has happened, but I think unionism is the root, and it needs revitalization. And I do thank you for the call.
It's ironic to me that our government is calling for a minimum wage of, $10 an hour, which is right now ridiculous. It should be more like 15 or 20.
Yeah, I think it definitely has to be 15 at the least.
Right, right. That might be, I would say 20 or around there would be a living wage.
Absolutely. I think it's also important to understand that what's happening in America today is a real turnaround in a negative way. Suddenly, it's harder and harder for people to afford college because of the money situation in most states. Going to university or even community colleges is out of reach of many, many people. When I was a Ute, you could go to the University of Oregon, or you could go to the University of California, or you could go to a community college for next to nothing. You had to pay for books and lodging and so on, but it was doable. Now it's really
My young son is graduating from Portland State this term, but they're out of money to loan him, so it's like, okay.
Also, the other, I'm glad you mentioned.
That should not be an issue for him right now, but it has become one.
Well, it's really important to remember that what has happened, instead of having lots of scholarships, instead of having lots of monies going to students, instead there are loans. The loans are private. The loans are terrible. They can't be canceled. You're stuck no matter what happens to you.
Right. I have one of those still.
I think there should be a moratorium on the whole business. Anyway, thank you very much for
all
the call.
Take care,
Francis. 231-8187. Theodore, hi.
Hey, Joe, you know, have you read up on Centralia, Washington and the Wobblies? And,
oh, yeah.
I mean, that's fascinating stuff. You know, having grown up in Skamania and Clark County, boy, they wouldn't dare teach you stuff like that.
No, in fact, the whole history of the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World, and their struggles, they were early industrial unionists. It was their first really large challenge to the ruling class in organized labor in modern times. And it's very important. And they were broken by violence and conspiracies.
Big timber interests.
Yeah.
You know, they were the multi-billionaires of their day.
Yeah, and the Western mining interests, including the Rockefellers.
But, you know, I think the overarching theme here is that after the Cold War in the, 1989-90, they didn't need any labor. They didn't need labor people anymore. There was no threat that the communists, the so-called communists, like the, you know, let's say a couple of people in the Wobblies might have been. There was no threat that the communists could turn them, right? So they didn't need unions. The unions essentially were, let's make these workers happy, and the commies won't turn them. Does that make sense?
Well, it's a little simplistic, but yeah, it makes sense.
But they don't care anymore. And Joe, this is politically incorrect, but the people before the 1965 Immigration Act, you didn't have 30 or 40 or 50 million Central Americans in this country trying to beat people out of jobs. I saw something yesterday. They said that an illegal immigrant or a guy who is a legal immigrant, I'm talking about males, is more likely to be employed than a resident who was born here.
Well, I don't know about that. I think it's really important to understand the larger picture. This nation it pretty much is a nation of immigrants.
That's BS, Joe.
No, it's not.
I'm not going to get mean with you.
No, come on. Look. We always demonize the most recent immigrants. We characterize the Irish in negative terms.
More immigrants, lower standard of living, Joe, and that's what you guys got.
Well, that's why unionism is important. You have to organize the workers. It's not a matter of skin color or language or where you come from. It's a matter of understanding what rights you want.
Basic economics. If you have an excess of supply coming in, prices will drop. That's basic economics. If there's more cars out there, the exact model that you want to buy, the dealership's got to drop the price if there's a ton of them. And therefore, when you have 30 to 50 million people coming in because you have no immigration laws, these young people, you know, think about the people, 50% in Oregon, that aren't even going to graduate from a high school.
Yeah, but I think you're what you're doing is you're conflating a bunch of different issues. The fact
it's a complex issue, Joe. But the thing is, you get excess supply, prices drop, and that's what happening to labor.
Okay,
period.
Okay,
that's how it is.
Well, I disagree with you.
How a market works, Joe.
Okay, man. I'm going to let you go. 231-8187 is the number to call. I got to do some business here. I got to remind you that at 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia. Cutting-edge news, views, interviews, and just plain horse sense with Chris Andre. At 10:15, we'll hear Flashpoints, investigative news journalism with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, we'll hear Stage and Studio with guest host Sarika Mehta. Today's guest is inaugural poet laureate Richard Blanco, author of the memoir The Prince of Los Cocoyos, I think. At 11:30, it's Art Focus with our host Joseph Galavan. Today's guest is Steve Graff, director of art at the Maryhill Museum of Art in the Gorge. It's a great museum, by the way, near Goldendale, Washington. We'll talk about the new season at Maryhill, which includes paintings, photography, glassworks, and folk textiles. Okay, that's what's going on here on cable. We hope you keep listening to us. We will always be representing the interests of ordinary working people. And, by the way, our staff, very small though it is and lousily paid though it is, are members of the Communication Workers of America. All right, let's hear from you. 231-8187. Bart.
Good morning, Joe.
Good morning.
You're doing very well today, keeping on task. I love that.
Thank you, I guess.
Well, sometimes when you're in with your partner, you guys talk a lot and don't listen very much. Anyway, Michael called earlier. I like Michael, and I like his him calling up and his, you know, pushing his viewpoints. But he talked about the state basically being bankrupt and scammed by the unions in the 70s and 80s. Well, I was a state employee during that time,
mm-hmm.
and worked at Portland State. But the situation that was going on there is very similar to the housing bubble. You know, the people that were negotiating for the state said, oh yeah, we can give them this large future gain because it's a go-go market and everything's going up and it's never going to stop. And so, you know, we can do that because then we don't have to pay them now. You know, that we're basically, we're margining the future, which is not going to be our responsibility, and we'll be retired with our fat accounts. But you don't have to pay anything today. It's all deferred till tomorrow. When I was working there, people in the food service who are full-time employees working, you know, 40 hours a week were eligible and receiving food stamps because their wages were so
low.
That's
really a good point.
I didn't make a very much money at that time. I was happy to have a good union job,
mm-hmm.
and I was happy to you know, have the benefits and the insurance that went with it. But I never had a lot of dough. You know, I was a single guy, so I was putting money away. But it would have been very hard to raise a family on that way.
And I'm really glad you mentioned the food stamp thing, because the fact of the matter is a large part of the full-time working force in America is eligible for things like food stamps because they're paid so lousy.
Right. Well, but during the 70s and 80s, there was a hiring freeze at the university. You know, if you worked in a department, I wasn't a teacher, I was a grunt. I worked in the printing department.
Mm-hmm.
But if you were an employee in the printing department who was not a temp, and there were lots and lots of people that were students that were working around in all the departments, but if you weren't a temp and you lost your job, quit, retired, whatever, your department would just have to get along without you until the hiring freeze was over. So many departments were 4, 5, 6 positions light, where everybody else was doubling up and tripling up their workload, and they weren't getting any more money for it. And, I mean, Michael's observation that this was a bad deal for the states, I would agree with that. Essentially, that was true. They negotiated poorly. Their bureaucrats, who were not union employees, negotiated poorly and made what turned out to be a bad deal. And it was, to some extent, a windfall for some of the state employees who made a, you know, had laid away enough money in retirement money. And so, yeah, that was an investment that did not pay off for the state. But the way that they entered into that contract was they thought they were getting one over on the union, and their budget for the year and for the biennium was staying within limits, so they were deferring this problem to the future, mm-hmm. which is kind of what our government is doing now in terms of not maintaining infrastructure or not paying for education or not paying for medical bills. Oh, well, we can't pay this right now, and we're just hoping the future will be better, but it's going to be somebody else's problem.
I think you're making a very good point, and I also think that it's important, I'm glad you mentioned infrastructure, to understand where the U.S. is in relation to other industrialized countries, particularly in Europe. We don't have high-speed rail, which is both an ecological and a business advantage. We don't have new bridges, decent. The highways are in bad repair. The bridges are in deadly repair. The whole infrastructure, including the system of delivery of electricity, is ancient by the standards of the rest of the world. And we are going to be and are already suffering from failures in those systems. Anyway, I really appreciate your call about what happened at Portland State.
A couple quick points about what you just said. Not only the electric infrastructure, but also the pipelines that everybody wants to put more nasty stuff through, mm-hmm. the rail beds everywhere, always weak. You know, that's what makes train crashes. Hey, guess what? We're going to have that nice toxic explosive oil coming to your town soon.
Yeah.
You know, the shipping ports, you know, the bridges, all of that stuff is being let go and really in terrible shape. And the people that are raking the money off the top are still raking the money off the top. And if everything blows up and fails, they're still going to be pretty comfortable. But we are not. Good day.
Thank you very much for the call. And you made some very good points. 231-8187. I think we have time for one or two calls. John, you're on the air.
Hey, I used to be a member of the UAW. I worked at the Oldsmobile plant when I got out of high school.
Uh-huh.
And comparing then and now, back then I made I think $3.50 an hour, opposed to I think it was like 88 cents minimum wage back then. And back then, that was before Reagan and the trickle-on theory.
Mm-hmm.
And the union was very strong. I made really good wages. I got excellent benefits. I didn't pay anything for Blue Cross. There was no deductible. About every 6 weeks, I got a check that was almost as much as a weekly check, called the cost of living check. And I had a committee man that would back me up if I got in trouble with the management. And it was actually very hard to be fired from Oldsmobile unless you continually mess up.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of people, many people, have no idea what a job in a strong union position is. And that's how it was back about 1969, 1970. A lot has happened since then, but that's how it was. That's how it could be. Right now, Oldsmobile doesn't even exist. There's a park, a Riverside Park, where the plant used to be.
That's right.
But And you know, that may be partly because of complacency on the union members, and then also, you know, bad design from the designers at GM.
Well, I think GM. I think GM screwed up on design. They ignored the growing markets in out of the Japanese automobiles and so on, and the European
absolutely.
Cars. Anyway, we're running out of time, man. So I got to let you go.
Thank you.
I do appreciate reminding us of what was going on in the auto industry.
Yeah, it was a good job.
It was, and it could be again. But we must, all of us, recognize the need. Workers.
Yeah, well, I don't think we need the right to get screwed laws by the management.
Really. Thank you very much for the call.
Thank you.
We need to understand, all of us, that we are individually never as strong as we are collectively. And we need to have democratic, powerful, organized labor. This is something that provides the demand that makes the economy thrive. We'll see you all next week. I wish you well. Stick with KBOO. It's got the best in news and music. It's worth listening every single day.
It's coming through a hole in the air from those Nats in Tiananmen Square. It's coming from the feel that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay. Democracy is coming to the USA.
KBOO and the Quinta Street Theater are proud to present a music documentary that raises the bar for the genre. Arrows into Infinity, the new documentary about the life of jazz musician Charles Lloyd, Thursday, April 9 at the Clinton Street Theater. Arrows into Infinity takes us on Lloyd's journey from the heights of jazz rock royalty to his life in seclusion and back again. Arrows into Infinity, the Portland premiere, Thursday, April 9, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton, Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm. on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. It's 9 o'clock. Here's what's coming up this morning on KBOO. First, it's Alternative Radio with host David Barsamian. Today, we'll hear a talk by Marjorie Cohn, professor of Thomas Jefferson School of Law in San Diego, entitled Death from Above, Drones. At 10, hear Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with host Chris Andre. At 10:15,